Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my absolute pleasure to have as my guest, Peter Samuelson. Peter is a veteran film producer behind more than two dozen feature films, including cult classics like Revenge of the Nerds, Tom and Viv, and Arlington Road. He is a trailblazing philanthropist and a social entrepreneur who has spent decades using storytelling and innovation to change lives. He has founded seven groundbreaking nonprofits, including co-founding the Starlight Children Foundation and Starbright World Online Network. He is the founder of the First Star Academies that partners with universities and local CPS to house, educate, inspire, and enable foster youth while in high school and to prepare them for college and to self-advocate. He also launched EDAR, the Everyone Deserves a Roof Initiative, to provide shelter for the unhoused, and Aspire, a media training academy for undergraduates outside of traditional film schools built on the values of social responsibility. And now he's added author to the list. His new book, Finding Happy, A User's Guide to Your Life with Lessons from Mine, is part memoir, part life manual, offering hard-won wisdom for millennials, Gen X, and anyone looking to live more meaningfully in a chaotic world. Peter has been married to his wife, Cheryl, for 35 years and continues to fight every day for those less fortunate, chief among them, abused and neglected children. Peter, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the show today.
It's my honor.
And we have to give a shout out to Candace Snyder, who you're on her Passion, Purpose, and Possibilities podcast. She is one of the ultimate matchmakers in the podcasting world and asked if I wanted to have an introduction to you. And it took me about a millisecond to say yes. And she set up the meeting, and we find ourselves at this point today where we're going to be talking about, your work in philanthropy, your new book, and anything else that happens to come up.
Well, she is, I think, of certain people in my life as crossroads of the universe people, and she is preeminently one of those where when they say, you need to meet Dave Roberts, I just say, yeah, when would you like to set it up? There are these people. I don't know if you know anything about Maimonides, but 800 years ago, he wrote about three levels of the soul. And everybody's got the middle level and the bottom level, but the top one is more of a membership society, only for those who are possessed with the idea of making the world a better place. And what he wrote was that when two such people meet for the very first time, they feel as though they've known each other 1,000 years, and they say, Hineni, here I am, what shall we do? And I think of Candace as one of those.
Yeah, and I also have learned, I think, over the years, Peter, that the people that come into our lives don't come into our lives by chance. It's by pure design. Candace and I met through the podcasting world, but it could have been anybody instead of Candace, but it was Candace. And I really firmly believe that we were put in our paths for a specific purpose at the specific time. And she's turned out to be a great friend and also a great colleague.
Well, this podcasting, I'd obviously been on a few before the book, but nothing like the number that I've been invited onto because of the book. And that's because that the publishers put a publicist, very good one, Kim Weiss, and she set up the first, 60 podcasts. But what is fascinating to me is there's a kind of fraternity and sorority of the top podcasters. They know each other and they refer guests to each other. So I've been, you know, none better than Candace, but a couple of others as well. I noticed that even though the publicist is now no longer on payroll, podcasts are still coming at me. So that's great. I'm honored to do them.
And like I said, I'm just thrilled that you chose my podcast to be one of the ones you're on. So one of my first questions, you've had an interesting journey from filmmaking to philanthropy. Tell our audience, give our audience a glimpse into that. How did your journey evolve from filmmaking to philanthropy specifically?
Well, it's, I think it's an interesting teaching moment. You develop a toolkit as a film producer. You get very good at entrepreneuring startup because every film is startup. It's a new crew. It's a new budget. It's a new script. You're in a new city or somewhere or other, and you have to make it all work. And your toolkit, which goes with you from film to film, is the sort of pattern recognition that you get where, although all the challenges are new, you sort of have dealt with something a bit similar in the past, which emboldens you to at least think that you know how to deal with a new one. So what I think virtually no one else has done is to take that same Sears Roebuck red toolkit with the big black handle on the top, to take it metaphorically into an entirely different arena, nothing to do with films. What happened is that I was in 1984 working already in Los Angeles as a producer. I had made at that point, I suppose, four films. And my cousin, a young actress, was still living in the UK. And she phoned me and said, "Help, I've done this thing." She had gone into the children's hospital there in costume with the rest of the cast of the film called Arabian Adventure, also in costume, to sort of entertain and make nice with the ill children in their beds. And she had said to a, I guess, 10-year-old little boy, Sean Honorati, she said, "Sean, what would make you really happy?" And Sean said, quick as a flash, "Oh, that's easy. I want to go to Disneyland." My cousin phoned me and said, "Now what do we do? Help." And I said, "Well, we're going to damn well have to bring him to Disneyland, aren't we? Go and talk to the doctor, talk to the mum." The doctor said, "This child is not long for this world." Not an inconsiderable thing to bring a seriously ill kid a long distance on an airplane. But sure, I can't see what the downside is. Maybe you'll make him happy. And the mother said, "Oh, would be Brenda. That would be lovely. We'd love to come to Los Angeles." We flew him over. They all stayed in my condominium in LA on Wilshire Boulevard. And we did 2 weeks of everything you probably shouldn't do with a very seriously ill little boy and his mum. And not just the Disney of it, but the Knott's Berry Farm of it and the restaurants and the beach and all the rest of it. And then he went home, having had a hoot of a time, and he passed away, which was not surprising because everyone, including he, knew that that's what was going to happen. So it went around in my head, and one of the things that film producers do is we bring together a team and we call meetings. And I found myself at the end of the boardroom table at Interscope, the company that I was helping to run, film company back then. And I had invited sort of one of these and two of those. And I said, "This is what we just did. Maybe we could do it again. Maybe we could do it half a dozen times a year." And everyone said yes. And the lawyer said, "What do you want to call it? I need to incorporate and get a 501c3, you know, to become a charity so people can get tax deductions." And I said, "I've given it no thought. I have no idea. What do we all want to call it?" And I'd had one date. It was back in my single days. And I'd had one date with an accountant, gorgeous looking accountant, very nice lady too. And I had omitted to call her because, you know, I don't know why, bad of me. So I phoned her and apologized for not having phoned. And I said, I need an accountant to come to a meeting for, a new charity idea. And would you please come? And she said, you should have called me, but I will come. So that was the second date. And when the lawyer said, what do you want to call it? She said, the accountant, you know that children's rhyme, starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. I wish I may, I wish I might have this wish I wish tonight. She said, why don't we call it the Starlight Children's Foundation? And we all said, yeah, that'd be great. Sounds happy. And the graphic designer that I had curated into the meeting said, I can see it in my mind's eye. It's a child reaching up for a star. And we all said, oh, that sounds wonderful. Send us some proofs. And that was the beginning of the Starlight Children's Foundation. Here we are, over 40 years ago. God knows where that time went. But we're in Australia, Canada, the United States, and the UK. We have raised and also spent approaching $1.2 billion. And we've helped, at this point, millions, several million children and their mums and dads. And all we do, it's still the same pure play, 8 psychosocial services to mitigate pain and make sad children who are ill happy, and along the way help their mums and dads and their siblings, Starlight. So that was number one. Number two, somebody introduced me. Kathy Kennedy introduced me to Steven Spielberg, supposed to be a 20-minute meeting, came out of his office 2.5 hours later with both of us. I don't know who was more excited, him or me. And he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, you'll be the chairman. It's going to be a new charity. I realized this is not going to fit because of the grown-ups involved. It needs to be its own thing. So he said, what will we call it? And I said, how does Starbright sound to you? So it became Starbright World, the world's very first online, navigable, avatar-based, three-dimensional space for teenagers primarily. And we installed it in hospitals all around the place in 1990. And we were fully operational by the early 1990s. And we had it live long before, you know, Facebook or MySpace or Second Life or any of those. We were there first, but of course we did it as a nonprofit, which may well have been stupid with the hindsight of time. But I did look up, and Mark Zuckerberg was 11 years old when we turned ours on at Digital World in 1994. So that was number two. And then, you know, First Star and EDAR and People for Peace and Aspire, and, you know, I could draw on forever. But I guess at this point, I've taken to answer long-windedly your original question. I realized that I could. And I realized that there were these massive problems in the world, which nobody seemed to have really cracked. And so with a group like Seriously Ill Kids or Foster Kids, I realized, well, they're never going to march, are they? You know, they don't vote. They haven't got any money. They don't even know they're hard done by. Someone has to help these kids. They'll never chain themselves to the railings outside the government building. So I did it a few times. And that's the philanthropic side of my life, which I have to say, I mean, I love being a film producer, and there is great joy to stand at the back of a theater and hear an audience laughing in the right places. However, I have to say, greater joy is to be found helping, you know, the unhoused, seriously ill children, undergraduates to choose a better future that helps people. And along the way, you know, there are 3 chapters in the book, The Meaning of Life, Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. And by the time you get to the end of the book, I'm pretty much saying, I've tried everything, and I believe the meaning of life And the way to find your own happiness is get out of yourself and go and help people. And you, that way you will build your legacy. It's how, oh, I didn't tell you. So that accounting lady, the one who dreamed up the name, we had a Christmas party at County USC Medical Center that first year with a live band in the auditorium. And some of the kids were so ill that they had to push them in their beds into where the band was. And the kids were all dancing. And we had these adult-sized marine mammal costumes that had been donated by SeaWorld. And one of them was the dolphin. And it had like a sort of little window grill thing in its, I guess, chest of the dolphin with the head up here. And inside there was the accounting lady. And I saw her looking at a little girl who couldn't get out of her hospital bed, but was dancing horizontally in her hospital bed. And I looked into the grill of the dolphin, and our accountant, Sarah, had all her mascara streaming down her face, because she was absolutely sobbing. And I thought to myself, oh, I think I love this woman. So there you go. That's where I got my wife.
You got a great accountant and you got an even better partner, Peter.
Yeah, well, I've never paid to have a tax return filed since I met Sarah. So, you know, love has its advantages. And we have four kids and three grandkids and more, I hope. My children are watching this. I'm expecting more grandkids. Here, you heard it on the Dave Roberts podcast.
There you go. We could put a call to action at the end of the podcast, too. Peter yes. wants more grandchildren. So if you're his children, yes. listen. For me, the fact that your philanthropy work focuses around improving the lives of children means a lot to me. I'm an educator myself, and I believe the future is our children. I tell my students this. I said, you know, I think the baby boomers in a lot of ways screwed things up. So I said, it's up to you now to move forward, hopefully with the lessons that not only I have learned through, you know, 70 years of living, but through other elders who you're going to run into.
You know, this is the first generation of young people with a shrink. If you don't count immigration, our population in the United States is shrinking. Yep. Why is that? One of my children, who shall be nameless, I said, where are my grandchildren? To which they said, well, looking at the world and, you know, authoritarianism and climate change and this, that, and the other, and a shrinking economy and inflation and nuclear proliferation. He said, we just don't think we're taking a watching brief to see whether this is a world which we can responsibly bring children into. I said, what are you talking about? They had babies in concentration camps. Come on. You're supposed to have more babies when things are rough. It's called the survival of the species. So I do think life expectancy rose for 100 years and is now falling, shrinking. What the hell is that? It's to do with grown-up error. It's to do with a lack of kindness. Somebody asked me actually over the weekend, what is the defining feature of all the people you don't like in various governments? And I said, at their core, I think they are cruel and unkind. And that is, and those things plus tribalism, this stupidity that they have a problem, you know, they go out to the beach in the summer to get a suntan. And of course, some of them put on orange makeup to look as though they have a suntan, except around the eyes. But they don't like people who are that dark in skin because they have more pigment. Like, seriously? Isn't that stupid? I mean, look in biology. What makes a healthy species is actually that the different subsets. What are the most healthy dogs? The mongrels, the ones that are bred between diverse subsets of dogs. Who are the least healthy dogs? We used to have a Samoyed dog. car. It had such trouble with its bones and arthritis and its hips. It ended its days with its rear end on a little trolley. Unhealthy in biology comes from purebred. Healthy comes from intermingling so that the gene pool does better. What is Tay-Sachs disease? It is a disease that only Jews have, and it's very bad. And if a kid gets it, their life expectancy is not good. And every time two Jewish people get married, they go down and have blood tests and make sure that you two people have to have it in one union in order for it to be passed down. And if one person has it, that's okay. But if both have it, you do something else like adopting, because you wouldn't want to give that to a child. But why is it? Well, it is because the Ashkenazi Jews who lived in Italy hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, they were sort of walled in ghettos, an Italian word that was used for where we lock up the Jews. Who did they marry? Partly for their own religious reasons, but also partly because they didn't intermingle with the rest of the population as they should have. They married other Jews, and eventually there was a genetic mutation that created Tay-Sachs. That's very bad. I believe that our responsibility as teachers, and frankly, it's my, mentoring and teaching is my best thing. I love my students. I climb over the furniture to try to be helpful. I think the book is a very good curriculum book. I've designed it so that teachers in high school and college can use it, and so can, you know, ministers and imams and rabbis and social workers and so forth. And it's divided into chapters by subject. So like there's a chapter, what is a good risk? What is a bad risk? How can you tell the difference? This is kind of important. I look back on my own adolescence and early 20s, and I nearly killed myself multiple times through complete stupidity, but also because of the way the brain is wired, that our young men, they don't develop a built-out prefrontal lobe. That's what helps you make a decision, kind of the chess game of life where you think 2, 3, 5 steps ahead. So until you're in your mid-20s, you rely on the amygdala, which is the reptilian. It's not even in the brain. It's halfway down inside your neck into the top of your spine. And the amygdala is fight or flight. Doesn't give it much thought about consequences. Oh, there's a tiger. Should I run or should I fight it? And it's not all bad because it can make decisions instantaneously. I just had one while I was over in the UK. I went out for a drink with my brother, my sister-in-law, an old friend, and an actress that they wanted me to meet because she might be really brilliant for this thing I'm trying to get made over there at the moment, Stolen Innocence. It's a 6-part miniseries. Her child, maybe 3.5, 4 years old, was sitting to my right, and I was fully engaged in conversation with the table of grown-ups. And I don't even know why I did it, and I never consciously did anything, but I found that I had seen that he was falling backwards off his chair, which didn't have a back, and that he was going to smash his skull on the cobblestones below. Mm-hmm. Didn't do it consciously. My amygdala told my body to lean to the right, my right hand to go out and down, my palm to go up, and I managed to stop him hitting the ground. And, you know, it was a moment. Oh, my God. And everybody high-fived me. And I thought to myself, thank you, amygdala. So it's not all bad, but it does make young men, including me when I was young, do incredibly stupid things. And that was the chapter while I was writing it that I realized I need to illustrate this book for young adults with anecdotes from my life, because one thing you get as a film producer are crazy adventures. You work with huge ego, narcissist lunatics. You know, I'm the guy who used to have to go around the set and say to the crew at 6:30 in the morning, do you mind going to wardrobe, Harry, and change your socks? You know that Peter won't work if anyone's wearing the color green because he's superstitious. Do me a favor, go change your socks. So I used examples in that chapter, which came flooding into me, really stupid things I did when I was young. You know, I was the kid who came home to my parents' house at 2 o'clock in the morning, very early Sunday morning, and I realized I haven't got my keys with me. And I thought, am I going to wake my father up at 2 o'clock in the morning? I thought, no, not doing that. So I thought of sleeping in the car. And then I realized that there was a sloping wall that went up at an angle to a corner of the house. And I realized that there was a drain pipe where the two walls met that I could climb up to the third floor where there was a half a brick wide sticking out ledge for decoration, I guess. And I got successfully up. The first two windows were closed and I held on by the grout and I went maybe 20 feet, 15 feet along to the right. And there was a window that I realized was open and I climbed in. I went to bed. The next day I was down in the back garden and I looked at the height of the ledge I'd inched along. I looked down at the stone flagstones down below, and I was so scared stiff that I went and threw up in the bushes because I thought, oh my God, I'd be dead. If I had slipped, and I nearly did, I would be dead. What a stupid thing. Why the hell did I do that? So it's a very interesting chapter, and it ends with points for reflection. What is the stupidest risk you've ever taken? That kind of thing. And what should you do if you are tempted to take a great risk? Answer, sleep on it and see if you can't kickstart the front of your brain to think of the consequences. So that's the way the book is organized. And what I did for the cover, I made a word cloud where the prevalence of the word determined how big the font would be on the cover. And although there are the very big ones, you know, how do you find success? How do I get a date? Where should I meet someone to love them? All that kind of thing. There are also very little words which still have quite a lot of importance. You know, being bullied, what do I do about it? That kind of thing. So it's really what I've learned from mentoring hundreds of kids through the charities. It's what I've learned seems to come up mostly, maybe 24 subjects. And I've written it very specifically so that teachers and lecturers and religious advisors and social workers and so forth, and parents, I hope, and grandparents. I've noticed, because I get emails, grandparents seem to buy two copies. It's fantastic. They buy one for them and one for the grandchild. And I've put, this publisher said I was raving mad, but I've put my email in the book. You have to really poke around and read the book to find it. But I get a steady stream of emails, which I love, because they tell me, some of them quite feisty, and I don't mind that at all. And I'm making notes for the second edition and so forth. But generally, I think it's been very helpful. It's a touchstone to help young adults find themselves and make the best of things. And some of it is structural, you know, how to be organized. Don't do your homework on the bus on the way to school on the last possible day, for God's sake. Do yourself a favor. Do it on the bus coming home. Or do it the night you come home when they give it to you, and you'll be the kid who can do something else. Play video games and don't worry about the homework because you already did it. Let stress who didn't do it, and it looms bigger and more awful. You know that, and also how to use a spider graph to analyze what actually are my problems. There's a mechanism called a spider graph where you pencil yourself into the middle and then you have arcs coming out, lines coming out, to boxes where you put your problems, your challenges, and then you put potential sort of who the people are who are part of those problems, and then out from each of them, you put possible solutions without prioritizing them, and that's your spider graph, and then you choose the low-hanging fruit and do, you can't do everything at once, so just do that one and that one, and then you try solutions, and some work and some don't, and eventually you find, oh, I've done a spider graph, because you put the solutions in the outer tier. Eventually, you've done a map of your life, and it's kind of cool. So things like that, you know, like hacks, if you like, but quite a lot of it has to do with self-esteem, how to find someone to love and to be loved by. Don't go to a bar. Seriously, you're going to go and choose someone that you want to spend time with who's drunk? What's wrong with that picture? Oh, you're going to do it on an app? And they've used AI on the pictures, so that's BS anyway. They don't even look like that. And they've lied about their age and what they're doing. And it's all nonsense. If you want to find someone to love and be loved by, get out of yourself and volunteer. Look to the right. Look to the left. Who are these people who wanted to volunteer for whatever cause I'm volunteering for? Oh, we have common interests. Very easy to ask them out. Go for it, you know? And the worst that will happen is you'll end up with friends in some nonprofit that's lucky to have you. And there's 10 other reasons why it's really good for you to volunteer. Like, if you have a good idea in a charity, watch how fast you'll be promoted. Anyone who dares raise their hand in a meeting and say, I have an idea, odds on, you'll be the vice president for implementation of that idea, possibly later in the same meeting, because charities, you know, spot cream that's rising and they act on it quicker than for-profits, where they have to pay more and so forth. And also you'll build your network. And building a network, and I've got a whole system in the book for how you use Google Sheets so that everyone you ever meet who might at one or two removes be useful to you, you create a line and you put their contact information and you say thank you for meeting with me, and it sends you a Google reminder in your calendar a week later to follow up, or a month later, or 3 months and 6 months and a year later. Thought I might update you on what I'm up to. Hope you don't mind. That's how you get jobs. That's how you meet more people. Somebody emails you back and says, I haven't got anything for you, but I'll tell you someone who does. May I introduce you to so-and-so? Yes, you say. And then I've got a whole Samuelson's life hacks. Remember, when I came to America, I didn't know a damn person. Well, it's not true. I knew one person. But I worked out how to use the network on a film set to meet other people. And then I also worked out how to meet people who have films upcoming. There is an absolute technique that involves showing up between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. because at a company where the person you need to get in the face of is there in the back, the receptionist who is there not to let you in, they go home at 6 o'clock. But the guy or the woman in the back, they're there until 8, 8:30. So if you get there between 6 and 8, and you'll either just be able to walk in, or if the receptionist is a masochist and is still there, then just lurk outside. And when you see the guy, do research on Google Images, what they look like, so you've got that firmly in your head, or you printed out a little photo. When you see them walking out and going towards the parking lot, just go and walk next to them and say, hello, I'm not stalking you, but I know that you're so-and-so. You directed one of my all-time favorite films, and I see that you're casting here. And I wondered, do you by any chance need an assistant? Or do they have anything in the front office that I might be able to do? I'll make coffee. I'll donate a week free so you can see that I'm really dedicated. And I have a whole system. Worked for me, I think can still work now. And, you know, every young person has to have a website with their stuff on it. that they can curate. And it's not the saying, sure, have Instagram, but without pictures with, you know, red cups of beer, that's not going to get you hired. Don't put anything online unless you want the recruiter that is interviewing you to see it. If it doesn't help you get a job, or someone's checking you out, or in this day and age, if there's anything there that you wouldn't want someone unhelpful to see because they might be government and have it in for you or something, well, don't damn well put it up there. So self-love and self-care is a big part of it. But anyway, long-winded answer. That's what the book is about. And that's how I didn't kill myself falling off that ledge.
Well, and the other thing I like about your book, and I had a chance to peruse a few of the chapters after you had sent it to me, and it's just, I think it speaks to our responsibility as elders for us to be able to teach the younger generation about life as we've seen it, but also in terms of the mistakes that we might have made. And so we can pass that on to the younger generation so they can not make the same mistakes that we made. But the other thing, Peter, is about leaving legacy. I think the Lakotas have also said that we will be forever known by the tracks that we leave behind. And I tell my students, make sure your tracks are long lasting. Make sure that the legacy you leave is going to go on long after you go dancing into another dimension. And this, your book is, I think, really a nice model for elders to see how they can pass on that information. The other thing I love about the book is that you have practical suggestions for good practical suggestions and skills for networking, for building relationships. And a lot of the children that you've worked with that have come from foster care situations or broken homes, didn't have those skills modeled for them. And we can't assume that every child is going to be moving forward to put their mark in the next generation has those skills. So we have to be able to say, here's how you do this. And
yes.
And that's the other thing that I like about your book. It's the practical as well as the philosophical that you merge quite nicely. And I think it would be a great teaching tool for any college, any university.
We ended up putting under Finding Happy, a user's guide to your life with lessons from mine, which I think, you know, it fits properly. I nearly used what I know now that I wish I knew when I was 18. And the publisher said, it's too specifically 18. We want to sell this book to 25-year-olds, and it's equally valid for them, and they might not buy it if it says 18 out loud. We do have an obligation. And you know, it's the paradigm of wisdom is the old so-and-so sitting on the chair, and the acolytes, the students, the disciples are sitting on the carpet cross-legged. And it is the passage of wisdom down to the students. And the only thing I would say now is, and I keep asking this, and I've yet to have anybody be able to answer this. So this is a challenge to you out there watching this podcast. When in history has it ever been the case that young adults knew more about anything, any subject, than their elders? Because clearly now, in the whole area of IT, AI, VR, AVR, and all the other acronyms, young people absolutely do know their fluency with everything online and everything that involves technology is much better than ours. When I do a lecture in a university and the silly overhead projector doesn't work, I don't stand on the desk. One of the students stands on the desks and they say, oh, look, they didn't plug in the HDMI. One person once said to me, by 1918, young male adults knew more about tank warfare than their parents did, which I think is probably true, but it's fairly narrow. Other than that, I don't know when in history there has been such an equalization between what the alphas and the Gen Z know and what the elders know. I think in some ways, Gen Z and the Alphas are morally superior. The bit that really bothers me with what is going on politically is not even that there are 36 really bad people, self-interested, corrupt, you know, authoritarian. I think Hitler did a great job. Let's see what we can do. Let's build some concentration camps. Mm-hmm. We won't kill them. We'll deport them. They're bad. But what really bothers me is he won fair and square. You know, at least I think he did. That's my belief. Did nobody apply critical thinking? There's nothing that has happened in the tribalism, racism, ignoring climate change, screwing up the planet, squandering of resources, abrogating the rule of law. It was all already there. You just had to study the people and read what they said. I mean, one of the, I'm not going to call it a saving grace, is that just like the 1930s in Germany, where you could pick up a copy at the bookstore of Mein Kampf, and right there, it told you exactly what he was going to do. Yeah. And you could see by 1932, 33, exactly where it was going, a very slippery slope. And then, you know, it ratcheted and ratcheted and ratcheted. Yeah. I think the same is true now. Unfortunately, maybe it's because of the failure of education. I don't know. We have an awful lot of misguided voters. And I wish that we ought to be able to agree on facts, but apparently we can't. Look in medicine. Look at what's going on in the NIH and the CDC. Yeah, the scientists have resigned. Seriously, are we going to have a gigantic number of additional RSV and COVID deaths because we've created fear of vaccines? One of the great areas of progress of the last 100 years of medicine boggles my mind.
And, you know, you make a great point about critical thinking. With my students, I encourage them to challenge everything. Don't take anything at face value. Don't take what I say at face value. Question it. Be skeptical about it. Research it. Take a look at all the facts from a variety of different credible sources and then find your truth within it. But don't take anything at face value. Yeah.
And Dave, don't only read what you already agree with. You know, if you're a lefty liberal, you can't just read MSNBC. You also need to read Fox News. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I read The Guardian. I read MSNBC. I read CNN. And I also read and watch Fox. And I read the reader comments of Breitbart, almost all of which I always disagree with. And some of them are mind-bogglingly wrong. However, I think there's an obligation. You want to be a citizen of this country? You should read the unfiltered people who don't agree with you. And that's bilateral. And no, there isn't moral equivalence. I don't think that in racism, in tribalism, there is moral equivalence between those who are discriminated against on the one hand and those who are doing the discriminating on the other. No, one side is wrong. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't read them. Having said all of that, I am also optimistic about the future. I believe democracy may survive if we would all, especially young people, get off our arse and go and vote in the midterms. And then in 2028, if the DNC could get its act together and actually come up with a candidate who was a centrist. I observe this in any meeting of, you know, several or many people, a board of directors or whatever, committee. There are always outliers. And then there is a sort of middle. There's a center. And what you need to do is start with the center, try and meet them one-on-one, and work outwards to the extremes, attempting to analyze and draw into the consensus the outliers, and you never get all of them. There are always people who say, no, that's flat out wrong, and I'm not voting for it. But the glory, and, you know, wise people created Robert's Rules of Order, you only need a majority. You need 51% of your board. Your job as the chair is to find the middle. I think the job of the President of the United States is to push back on this ridiculously polarized country that evil people, for self-aggrandizing and corrupt reasons, have fueled the polarization. And it's also been fueled by online media. You know, people don't read what they don't already agree with. Well, that's nonsense. And I think as teachers, you have it right, Dave. We need to be encouraging people and not just, you know, tell the kids who skew right, you need to read, you know, the left-wing opinions. Do it the other way around as well. And then have a big old debate. One of the best things that happened to me when I went to college, I only went because I got a scholarship, but I joined the Cambridge Union Society, where we were taught to debate. And I actually debated with and against Arianna Stassinopoulos. Arianna Stassinopoulos, who became Huffington, you know, of the Huffington Post, etc. Learning to debate, they used to do a thing where they would sound a gong while you were speaking. It's kind of rude. And you had to change sides and seamlessly transition into advocating against whatever you just said. And they would do that several times. And so the ability to debate is a wonderful thing. But even more important than that is the ability to embrace and understand and learn from other.
Yes.
And take your own view. God gave you a brain, or biology gave you a brain. You got a brain from somewhere. And if you're over 25 as a young man, you might even have a prefrontal lobe. Use your brain. You are not an idiot. You are a thinking young adult. Take a view, but do it from information. And by the way, science, the word, comes from the Greek skio, and then the Latin skio, I know. It's knowledge. Science is knowledge. Yep. And they've organized a system over the better part of 100 years where scientists develop a hypothesis, they test it, they publish their findings, they are then second-guessed by uninvolved scientists. If they got something wrong, the science evolves. They are open to counter views. You test it in a test tube, and you test it on, you know, massive, great surveys in the subject group. You don't test it with what will get you a cheer from people who already agree with you. No, you have to stand it up against the opposition. But you and your opposition need to find common ground in the science. And you can't just rewrite the science because it serves some bizarre brain worm in your head. I mean, I have no idea what's going on there. I mean, it is irrefutable science that long COVID is a thing, and which has no cure. And so is COVID itself a serious, especially in vulnerable groups, with a comorbidity and so on and so forth, you don't want to get it. And if you are vaccinated, you have something like a 90% less chance of getting the damn thing. Why would anybody oppose that? You know, why would they ignore the science? I guess that is what quackery is.
Yep.
You know? And it's usually corrupt. They're usually selling something. If you notice someone is selling an elixir, they're usually making money on the elixir. Some of these blowhards, I have to say, with podcasts, they also have a website where you can buy the pills in the bottle and all the nonsense. Mm-hmm. That is the science that they are pushing. So I have turned a corner, and really only in the last year, having been a student of the 1930s in Germany, and also a student of narcissism, because God knows you have to work with a bunch of narcissists in the industry, in the television industry. I've decided, really, as part of writing the book, I need to be braver, and I need to speak truth to power, and to hell with them. I'll just call it as I see it, because what I'm trying to do is to help young people to develop critical thinking. Don't be in a cult. It is not worthy of you. Think it through. And if, having thought about it and done your research, you have access to the greatest brains in the world. You can hyperlink to expertise left, right, and center. Don't take your view based on that you only ever listen to Rachel Maddow or Hannity or anybody in between. Take your view because you listen to both in the middle. It's a terrible sign that so many politicians are resigning now because it is just too horrible and also underpaid to be a centrist in a polarized Senate, House, state legislature, city, county legislature. It's just horrible, but we need those people back. And we also need to try to encourage young adults to grow up wanting to fix things. Back to Maimonides at the beginning. Hineni, I feel as though I've known you 1,000 years. What shall we do?
That's right. Yeah, and it's going to be important for the younger generation, like you said, to provide a fix, but they're not going to be able to until critical thinking is reinforced throughout society, until they're encouraged to do it. And I think you're right. We have to take a look at both sides of any issue, particularly the side that we don't agree with, in order to understand what resources they've used to come to those conclusions. Try to sit down and have a conversation to better understand each other's side, not necessarily agree with it, but to understand it. And then we might be able to find some similarities within the differences that we know exist. But we're not going to be able to do it.
It doesn't mean... Yeah, it doesn't mean we have to agree.
No.
We still disagree, but we need to have civil discourse. In Berlin, Germany, where they know a thing about institutionalized hatred, there is a triangular park, mostly grass and a few trees. On one side of it is a mosque. On another side of it is a synagogue. On our third side of it is a church. And they do their own thing separately. Except that once a month, they have events in the park where they do stuff together. Potluck dinner, guest speaker, and they take turns at whose guest speaker it is and so forth. That is how you build civil society.
Yes.
Despots are helped by people fearing other. Because what the despot says is, you're not scared of those people who look different and dress different. You're actually not. They are scared, but they say you don't need to be scared. You should hate them, because hatred is a positive emotion that you can feel righteous about hating people, where you can't feel good about being scared of them. And that is how despots aggrandize themselves. Look how they always choose scapegoats who are different than their base. They are constantly persuading their base that hating people who are different is, you know, the way to feel better about yourself. This morning at the summit that the Chinese, the Russians, and the North Koreans just had somewhere in China, Kim Jong-un took with him his young daughter, who I believe is only in her early teens, nobody knows. But apparently by bringing her to this multilateral conference, he was anointing her the future leader. She is the great-granddaughter of the original Kim, who founded the despotic dynasty. But if you look at it, they more often than not, they bring their children in and they bring their nephews and nieces and all the rest of it. Why? Well, because they can and because it's corrupt, you know? I think we live in dangerous times. It's an old Chinese curse. I would like part of my legacy to be the inculcation of critical thinking alongside life hacks and generosity and kindness and pay it forwards for young adults. It's difficult to imagine that they could do a worse job on block than us, our generation. We should help them learn from our mistakes and get it right, especially as in plain sight in front of them, there are people, you know, taking backhanders from the oil and gas industry and encouraging drilling in public lands, which everybody with a brain in their head knows from the science is going to make the temperature here yesterday in the San Fernando Valley was 102 degrees. At what point will people say, as has always been the case in industry, we just can't live here anymore? It's 126 degrees. I was just in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, they better not have a power cut there because I'm telling you, that was really hot. And, you know, it's going to get unimaginably hot because we will exceed 2% and the sea levels are rising. You know, good luck in the Keys of Florida. They're all going to be underwater. Good luck, Lower Manhattan. Maybe they'll fend it off for a generation by building seawalls at enormous expense. And, you know, along the coast, they'll fend it off a bit by putting the houses on stilts. And indeed they are. But in the end, Mother Nature, the polar ice caps are melting. The sea levels are going to, in one generation, they're going to rise 6 feet. Well, a lot of stuff will be underwater in 6 feet. I know a lot of places where I've been on the road next to the beach, which has buildings on either side of it. Not good. So critical thinking, science, SCIO, I know, using your tools, using all the IT, reading experts, reading people you don't agree with, see if they've got anything to offer. And also, if it looks like a fish and smells like a fish, it's probably a fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Occam's razor would be the complicated, highfalutin way of explaining the most obvious solution is usually the right answer. Young people have access to that, and it is not in the present leadership of the CDC. It's in the people who got fired last week.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I said, the future is with our young people. And, you know, I know I'm optimistic that things are going to change. And one of the kind of astrological events that have kind of given me hope was there was a great conjunction of 2020. I don't know if you'd heard of this, where Mars and Jupiter came together to form a Christmas star. And that has not happened. That hadn't happened up until 2020 for 450 years. And that was a signal to the return of the age of Aquarius, where there would be peace, inclusivity, tolerance of other people's objectives. And again, like with anything that is spiritual in nature, you know, spirituality doesn't go on the passage of physical time. It's a transition. But that groundwork has been laid. And I can hope that with the message that you're giving with critical thinking for the younger generation, the message I'll continue to give to my students to pass that forward, that we can come to a world that values those qualities. So that's my hope for the future. I may not live long enough to see that. I may see it from another dimension, but that is my hope, Pete.
I'll be gone, but my children and grandchildren, et cetera, will be gone. And this book will, I hope, be in printing number edition, whatever.
Yeah.
I also put into the book one chapter of a different book. I started writing a novel. And then I realized, oh, I'm not a novelist of fiction, but I wrote a novel about an alien in a spacecraft coming down to Earth because the higher civilization on their planet has been visiting since the Stone Age, and they've observed that all civilizations everywhere in the solar system eventually implode and wipe themselves out for one of three reasons. They either discover fire, they burn the hydrocarbons and lose their ozone shield and this, that, and the other, or they discover how to split the atom, and then they build nuclear weapons, which end up being used, and some of them had thrown their planet off its axis to spiral off, taking all the protagonists in the nuclear war with them, with the planet. The other thing, tribalism, hatred of other. If you can't get past that, you'll eventually couple that with climate change and mass migration. No law will ever be high enough to stop people when the temperature is 140 degrees in the shade. Mm-hmm. They will all find a way of going towards the poles, because that will be the only way that they will live and have water and all the rest of it. And they won't take no for an answer. And good, there won't be weapons that can keep them out, or walls. I think there are grim things, but I also think the next generation have tools that will serve them well that we never had, you and I. And I hope the book, in some little way, will help them find and build their happy.
And speaking of the book, and how can people purchase your book? How can they get in touch with you to find out more about what you're doing? Give our listeners some ways that they can contact you and purchase the book.
The book is everywhere. It's on Amazon. It's on barnesandnoble.com. It's also an ebook and it's an audio book. It's pretty much everywhere. And the easiest thing is just go on Amazon. If you like listening, you can listen to it. And if you want to read it, it's called Finding Happy. And if you read it and it helps you, please review it, because I've been learning the craft of successfully being an author, and it has a great deal to do with the reviews on Amazon. Nobody seems to bother to review stuff anywhere else, but Amazon, get it there and then review it there. Also, if you are a teacher, if you can order more than 25 copies in one go, you can get a massive discount. The discount rises to as much as 60%, but you've got to order in bulk, which of course will work fine for a class. And Bulk Books is the place that you do that, just to give them a little plug. But you can't buy it in less than 25 copies, but shipping is free. And you don't have to pay, I think you don't have to pay tax if you are an institution of learning. Mm-hmm. So all good. I really appreciate your time, and I love being on.
Peter, it was a blast having you on the show today. I mean, you left our listeners with so much wisdom and so many good takeaways from your book, from your life. Thank you for your time, your energy, and I hope we can do this again in the future sometime.
Absolutely. If you send me the link, we will blast it out. There's a gentleman, a young man called Zach, who is doing my social media, because God knows I'm a Luddite. But if you send me the link, we will push it out on LinkedIn and Instagram and YouTube and old X, or whatever it's called this week. Mm-hmm. Facebook. Does anybody still look at that?
I'll make sure that the links get to you and you can get those to Zach, and Zach can work his magic with it. So, Peter, thank you so much again for a great conversation. I wish you well in the future. Much success with the book, with your philanthropic endeavors, and also your future filmmaking. Thank you again. And for those on YouTube, you saw Peter flash prominently the cover to Finding Happy. Get his book. It's terrific. It's a great primer for the younger generation, and just an example of how to pass on the wisdom of living to the younger generation. So again, Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you. If you also ask me how anyone can contact me, My website is www.samuelson.la.
Okay.
www.samuelson.la, and everything is there, and there's also a place to send a message.
Perfect, and I'll make sure all of that gets in the episode notes before the podcast goes live. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.